Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
My name is Lisa Gray, and I am going to be your moderator for this morning's panel called What Women Talk with four amazing writers and their books. First, we have Tamsin Wolfe, who's at my far right. Then we have Aya De Leon and Laura Lindstedt and Lisa Locascio. And their books all explore the question in some way, the idea, the concept of what do women want? But before we get started, I would like to remind you to, one, turn off your cell phones. And I would like to say thank you, shout out to our sponsors for this afternoon or this morning's event. We have Alley Cat Books, and I cannot find that list. I'm so sorry. I'll tell you about the sponsors at the end. So we're going to engage in a conversation about these four novels, and then we're going to have a Q&A. But one of the things that I really like to do is to have the audience be a part of the conversation with the authors. So I may ask you a couple questions even before we get to the Q&A session. Is that okay with you? Okay, perfect. So I am going to briefly read the back flap biography for each of our authors, okay? First, we have Laura Lindstedt, who burst onto the Finnish literary scene in 2007 with her debut novel, Scissors, which earned her a nomination for the Finlandia Prize, the country's most prestigious literary honor. Lindstedt's second novel, One Iron, continued her critical success, winning the 2015 Finlandia Prize and becoming an international bestseller. She lives in Helsinki. And next, we have Aya De Leon. Aya teaches creative writing in UC Berkeley's African American Studies Department. Her work has been acclaimed in The Village Voice, The Washington Post, the American Theater Magazine. Her writing has been featured in Guernica, Essence, Ebony, The Huffington Post, and Bitch Magazine. She is an alumna of Cave Canem and Vona. Visit her online at ayadeleon.com, on Twitter at ayadeleon, or on Facebook. And then we have the fabulous Tamsin Wolfe, who is a professor in Princeton University's English department, where she specializes in modern and contemporary drama, voice, directing, and dramaturgy. She has published essays in numerous journals and is the author of Mendel's Theater, Hereditary Eugenics, and Early 20th Century American Drama. Juno's Swans is her first novel. And last, but of course not least, we have Lisa Locascio, whose work has been published in The Believer, Salon, N Plus One, Book Forum, Ten House, American Short Fiction, The Los Angeles Review of Books, and elsewhere. She is also co-publisher of Joyland and editor of 7x7 LA. Open Me is her first novel. So, welcome to our panelists. And before we dive in, each of you has prepared a brief segment to read for folks before we dive into conversation to kind of frame the discussion and you get a sense of the work. Okay? Ready? Who wants to go first? I'll be like in school. I will call on somebody. Okay. How about Aya, you've got your open, you're ready to go.
Just trying to be prepared. Okay.
This book is called Side Chick Nation. And it's the first book that to be published about Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. And we have a sort of a reluctant heroine, and so what she wants in this moment is just to get through the hurricane and not to have to really be present or pay attention. Her name is Dulce. Water flooded the storage space as Dulce slept. It seeped through the metal slats in the pull-down door of the storage space. It pooled on the concrete floor. It rose around the mattress where Dulce was sleeping, although she was not exactly sleeping, more like in a stupor or a spell from the cocktail of rum and marijuana. Water seeped up, turning the mattress into a giant sponge. The moisture soaked into the fabric of her clothes. Inch by inch, the line crept up her feet. her beautifully painted blue toenails. It saturated her hair, destroying the remains of a blowout, her hair blooming into springing curls all around her head. Still she slept. Her shoulder flinched with the moisture tickling her ear canal, then both ears filled and the tickle was gone. Her body stilled again in sleep. The now full canals dulled the howls of the storm. The flooding outside was anything but gentle, yet the water could only seep in through the slats in the metal door and the crack at the bottom above the cement floor. So the water level rose up slowly. It crept up gently along her neck, her jawline, her cheekbone. The water sidled up tenderly like a lover.
Thank you. How about Tamsin?
Sure. Okay, this is a short passage from Juno Swans, which is about a transformative summer for a 17-year-old girl named Nina, who is speaking. And she has met the girl that she's fallen in love with. 2 weeks later, I slid my hand into hers one night at a crowded party when I was leaving and wanted her attention before I left. Just to say goodbye, I'm sure I told myself, although you know it's just as likely that I thought I would die if I went one more minute without touching her. But what I thought was, I'll just get her attention to say goodnight. What I do know is that when I slid my hand into hers, the words slid and hand, mine, and hers were blown open, just stretched to breaking like the skin of a balloon, as if I didn't know or had to relearn what sliding was. The ease, the smoothness, the grace, the arms outstretched, glee and terror of a foolhardy child hurtling down the chute at the playground. She held my hand. People around us were talking, but they were only so many silent movie mouths with oversized puppet heads. The world was between our palms, so discreetly and politely pressed, so heated and limitless, curious and fervent. The world contracted to that electric violet place. If we had opened our hands right then, the light streaming out would have dazzled you blind. I didn't look at her. I couldn't look at her. I just held that pulsing jewel and marveled, brilliantly distracted. You know this to be true. Deserter, betrayer, coward, liar, Holocaust denier. You know who you are.
How about we jump to Lisa?
This was it then. This was why everything had happened. He lapped at me, and I stared at the white ceiling, beginning to understand. Pleasure could be mine, could go from being untouchable as an ancient ship to something real that happened between my legs, passing from the mouth of a person I barely knew into my body. If I'd only known it was possible to feel this way, that the feelings I could conjure alone on my own body could enter this higher, finer evolution, every moment of my life might have been easier. Every pain bearable, every disappointment manageable. I bucked and roiled under his tongue and lips and face, falling through a collapsing series of rooms, one into another, after another, after another, into a shapeless, wonderful bottomlessness, like a scene from a cartoon. Clocks and books and furniture floated around me as I went down, 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 and eventually landed softly on some dim, warm floor. I twisted my thighs around his face. My body took over, tightening and releasing a deep muscle, trying to trap his tongue to keep him there forever. I'm on fire, I thought. My bones are cooking to dust. All of me melting, breaking down. Faster, faster. The world changing with my every shuddering breath. I climbed the wall of pleasure and looked out from my flaming body, my eyes wet and low in my head. I was alone, riding my body. Purple, I thought, purple. I saw purple smoke, and I came in his mouth. Thank you.
Uh,
All right, I'm going to read a short passage from my book called Oneiron.
Oneiron,
because one iron, I have learned later on, it's a golf term. So Oneiron doesn't mean kind of directly anything. It's the same in Finnish and in every language. It's an imaginary word. I have kind of invented. It has some roots, but maybe we can discuss it later. And there are seven main characters. All of them are dead women. And dead, and they don't know it yet. And this one is Polina. She's from Russia, Moscow, and she's alcoholic. She can't read books without drinking alcohol. She goes to the deep meanings just by drinking a little bit and then reading and drinking and reading. So that's her sad story. Polina didn't feel much guilt over her drinking. She gained amazing knowledge that she would have missed without it. The books wouldn't have sung to her without this wondrous secret window, which sometimes nearly flew off its hinges. That was worth any side effects. The moment when a book began its raging storm, when it began to surrender in a silken symphony, when all the voices of all the instruments were individually and collectively audible. The friend's horn, the oboe, the contrabass, irony, context, intertextuality. If only she could share this someday.
Okay, so I sent out an email to the four panelists before the session, and I wanted us to think about four overarching questions that kind of guide this conversation. And those four questions are, what motivates or drive your heroines to get what they want? How do you think your heroines' motivations mirror those of your readers? Has the answers to the question, what women want, changed over time? And how do you see this change reflected in the literature, if at all? And what do you want readers to understand about what women want when they read your book? So, as we ponder these kind of overarching questions, what do women want, ladies? And how do you think that this is reflected in the books that you've created?
I could start by saying that it's, of course, a question what a woman is at all. Mm-hmm. So I tend to deconstruct every concept in my writing. It's necessary because you don't use your common sense when you read. You have to think over and over again the significations and everything. But for me, for example, my female characters, I have only written female characters for some reason. They are driven by very different kind of affections, even obsessions. And it's not clear what is behind these needs. Mm-hmm. I think that the whole book is kind of answer in the end, what motivates it, but it's not clear at all. So reader has to read the book to find it out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts on that?
I was very interested in writing an adventure story, and the protagonist of my book is an 18-year-old girl right out of high school who finds herself unexpectedly in rural northern Denmark. So one thing that's been interesting to me about the reception of my book is that it's described often as a coming-of-age story, which I think by dint of its shape it is, but I never thought of it in those terms. I just thought about how for many of us, adventure and journey is metaphysical because it navigates interior rather than exterior landscapes and states. And we have a lot of literature about the sort of interpersonal adventures of young male-identified people, and I wanted to give voice to a narrative about the way that, for young women, that also often means navigating relationships and connections and the mystery of your own body.
Hmm. So I write a feminist heist series. So, and it's a group of women who run a clinic for women that particularly serves sex workers in New York City. So The kind of the beginning of the series is about how these women want to continue to be able to provide life-saving services to their community. And as anyone who's run a nonprofit, there's that moment where people are like knee-deep in grant proposals and they're like, why don't we just rob a bank, right? And so this is that fantasy come to life. So I think, you know, part of what this group of women who are working together, they want is they want to be able to ensure the survival of their community. And then, you know, in each book, there are different things they're taking on. The first book is sort of the heist. The second book, there's a stripper strike. The third book has to do with respectability politics and kind of like immigrants and kind of the American dream is just so close within reach and kind of striving for that kind of respectability and figuring out maybe that that's not really the goal. The other thing that I'm playing with here is a lot of tropes in popular fiction. So they're heists and they're urban fiction, but they're also romance. And for me, I didn't come up reading a lot of romance, but, you know, in part because I'm a feminist and romance is complicated around that. So part of what these women want is they want to be loved and be their powerful selves. So one of the things that's been fun to play with in the series is the idea that the real obstacle between this heterosexual couple getting together is the man's cooperation with patriarchy, and that the obstacle that needs to be overcome is that he needs to figure out that he needs to be more loyal to the woman he loves than to his toxic masculine training. And these are all stories of, you know, women of color partnering with men of color. So that's the other thing that folks want, that women want, I think, to be able to be loved in a way that we continue to have integrity and be ourselves.
I want to ask you, Aya, very specifically about your book, because it kind of also plays with this idea of what the Robin Hood figure is like and allows a female character to take on that lead role of and have that kind of control. And there is this kind of play around what does control look like. And because it takes place within the sex industry, right, sex becomes power. Talk a little bit about that. And for each of you, I feel like there is kind of like this power in finding what it means to own your sexuality in a way, right? Talk a little bit about that in terms of what women want and what that means for us.
Well, the thing that I would say is, you know, part of all of that came out of what I wanted, which was to be able to sell a novel, right? So I started out writing these novels that were kind of literary fiction with all these heavy politics and, you know, and they didn't have any tropes, right? Like, you know, I'd be like, there's this relationship and they're going to break up in the end, you know, because no, it won't be a happy ending, you know? So I was writing this stuff that, years ago, I look back at, I still like it. I still think it's worth, you know, maybe one day it'll get published. But I couldn't figure out how to navigate the literary industry at that time in the early 2000s with this sort of stuff that didn't fit anywhere. And I knew that for me, the way that I'm positioned in the literary industry as a Black Latina woman, like, you know, sex is what is part of how books sell in a lot of ways for my demographic, right? And so sex and romance. So I was like, if I'm going to write about sex in this sort of social experiment to put heavy-duty radical politics into something that's like sexy and commercial, it won't just be sex, it'll be sex work. Because sex work is extremely political. And so you can have people who are having a lot of sex, but it's happening at the intersection of gender, capitalism, race, nationality, and I could be in this really politicized location. So for me, that was really kind of where it came from. And then, you know, I wanted to play with that, and the idea of heist and Robin Hood came up immediately. And then, you know, a lot of it unfolded, particularly the protagonist of the first book. Each book has a different protagonist, and so that they can have the arc of their life being forever changed. And the protagonist of the first book is Puerto Rican.
And for me, that was also really important because there's something about the exotification of Latina women, particularly Afro-Latina women, and the ways that folks are fetishized sexually that I thought really was going to work. And playing with her being this very objectified person who, you know, moves into survival sex when she's orphaned as a teen, but then really she's kind of a criminal financial mastermind, and then how that comes out. So I was really playing with, you know, how is it that women are seen versus what's going on inside and what set of circumstances in their lives can bring out these kind of intense magical gifts. Mm-hmm. And so that was some of what I was playing with there.
Okay. And then for Lisa and Tamsin, who both of your protagonists are younger women, but they're also on this kind of physical and metaphysical journey of self-discovery. Talk a little bit about that. And sex plays heavily into their kind of journey, but also it's relevant, and yet it also is kind of like backseat. Talk a little bit about that.
Okay. Do you want me to try first? Yeah. All right. Well, like Lisa, this book was like Lisa's book, branded as a coming-of-age book, and I hadn't thought about it that way. Again, I was interested similarly, I think, in a girl striking out on her own, and some of the initial editorial response as well as the critical response said, she can't do this. Like, where is she, how can she be? She's spending the summer on Cape Cod with her best friend, and she's 17. That's not possible. And this is 1987, so, you know, historical fiction, first of all. but it also was just shocking to me. I mean, how the kind of resistance and paternalism and weird stuff people had around even the idea of a girl going out and doing something somewhere else, you know, for herself. And then I have always responded to girls who strike out in every sense of that phrase. Those are the stories that spoke to me, and I like backing it up in terms of age. I mean, this narrator, she's a strong, strong sense of her own sexuality from early, right? And she wants to be challenged and is looking for that. And I don't, there are not enough examples of that that interest me. So that was a big piece of this, I think.
A story I like to tell about my book is that it began when I started writing it in 2010 as a time-traveling YA romance with Vikings. Everything about it changed, but I think what compelled me about the original plot that stayed with the book is that I was interested in a story about a young person coming into their values. Mm-hmm. So as much as my book does have a lot of sex in it and is what, you know, many anonymous intimate in internet commenters have described as, you know, she's stupid, she's crazy, if she was my daughter, I'd lock her in my basement, which really says more about the person who wrote that than my character. You know, it's also a book about an American encountering European xenophobia towards Muslims who have settled in Denmark. Mm-hmm. And as an American who encountered that xenophobia, I was really fascinated and horrified because I generally think of the United States as really the MVP of systemic oppression, and so seeing how that played out in a different context was really interesting. So I was lucky in that the editor and agent that I worked with didn't question my character's freedom, but I was not prepared at all for the prudishness of many readers who saw the behavior of a character who was, you know, in my opinion, actually pretty tame as outlandish, whereas, again, I just think if this was a male character, there would be a lot more focus on how brave he is and how cunning, because I think it is brave and cunning to be a young person who engages intimately with other people. I think it's frightening to offer yourself to the world and to be willing to go through that experience. But I also, you know, it was hard for me, even a decade removed from the age of my character, to recreate that kind of, like, blessed foolishness that a teenager can have. And I wanted her to be heroic in ways that ultimately were somewhat tamped down because I realized that her heroism was in the slow growth of those values rather than in some sort of, you know, superhero punch to the system. That's probably the sequel.
Yes, please.
Actually, my third novel, which came out a month ago in Finland, hasn't been translated yet to any other language. My friend Natalia is a story about one woman called Natalia really wants, and she goes to see her therapist to find out. She has sexual obsessions. She thinks all the time, have sexual images in her mind and can't do anything else than think about sex. And then she starts a therapist process, and that is a kind of investigation in a literary form that how much feminine desire reflects masculine desire and how you can get out of it and how can you find your own desires. Mm-hmm. And as well, storytelling as a form of seduction. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But in Oneiron, there is sex as well. So,
yes, there is.
So it starts, it's a prologue where the last of these women called Ulrike, who's from Salzburg, Austria, she comes to this empty white space. The setup is that it's nothing but whiteness all around, and they jump up one by one to this space and don't understand how they are there and what has happened and so on. And these other women give oral sex to Ulrike because one thing, what they already know, but Ulrike doesn't know, that they lose senses, physical touch, feelings in this afterlife. They can only hear and talk and see, but they don't feel anymore. So giving oral sex to Ulrike is like a welcoming present to her in this story context. Although this is quite heterosexual novel, I would say, there is a lot of queer stuff in it. And for example, Rosa Immaculada, who is from Brazil, she has had a heart transplant surgery, and she has inside her donated heart of a young man, and she starts to feel young men's desire when this organ is inside her, and she sees very vivid dreams of penetrating into a woman, although she's a heterosexual. So that kind of stuff is there written in this book.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit for us, Laura, about, because you've got seven women who are very well-crafted, deeply round characters, right? So what was it like to juggle that?
It was kind of hard because there is no Finnish protagonist in this book at all. But it was a poetical starting point for me because these women can't communicate with each other a shared language. It is, of course, English they start to communicate because it's the only language that is kind of common lingua franca in this world. But there is only one Shlomit from New York to whom it's mother language. So I thought that as an author, I really need to be in the same position as these females are in the mm-hmm. book. I can't kind of be more familiar to one of them. But I did need to do a lot of background research, of course, and it took 8 years to write this book, not only because there are seven women from different countries, but for many reasons, but it took a long time to me. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What about for the others of you who have these multiple characters that come up, that your plot lines are moving as they move through the text, right? And I'm thinking for Tamsin, Nina and the storyline with both her two lovers, right? We get Titch and we get Sarah, right?
Well, Titch is her friend.
Her best friend, I'm
Sarah
sorry, right?
Her, yeah.
So, but there's, and there's kind of like almost this this tension between the best friend and the new girlfriend.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about that.
I mean, that little passage that I read to you, I think it's because in my life there have been, women have both erupted on the scene and vanished from the scene, like dropped off the face of my life, and then also just sprung up in ways that are really disorienting. And so that's something that I was working through in the book. And then there are, Nina has relationship. I mean, she has a relationship to her mother and to her grandmother, to her friend and to her lover that are, there are a lot of complicated relationships mm-hmm. between these women, and there's just a kind of, I don't even know how to describe it, a spectrum, right? That's not quite the right way of thinking about it. A universe of these different kinds of connections between women for her, all the formative, really formative relationships for her with women. I would say there's a way in which I wrote myself into a corner a little bit, moving off of the perspective question, because if you're writing about an adolescent who's in love in a first-person narration. It's like super myopic, right? Like, I mean, I really wanted to focus on a girl, but it means it's just kind of narrow in a way that is hard to... there's so much going on around her that she can't... we need to get a glimpse of, but she can't... she's not going to fully understand. And that's a larger picture thing, like AIDS and abuse and eating disorders, all kinds of things that are in the picture, but which she's not going to see. But also it just, I felt it's super circumscribed in a very mm-hmm. particular way. Mm-hmm. That was hard, that was challenging.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Lisa?
I mean, so my book, like Tamsin's, contains a really important friendship between the protagonist Roxana and her friend Sylvie, and they have kind of a fraught alpha-beta relationship with elements of what could be, I think, sort of sloppily described as homoeroticism, but it kind of, to me, is just this sort of like gateway between childhood and adulthood where physical intimacy with a close friend is both erotic and also like sort of like the love of the self and the discovery of the self. But then she's engaging with these two men who are very different from her, and one of whom is a Bosnian Muslim refugee in Denmark. And so I did a lot of research about the experience of that diaspora as it took shape in Northern Europe and particularly in the Jutland region of Denmark. I was interested in portraying, you know, similar to what my co-panelists have said, the way that the myopia of infatuation and love is also sort of a lust for knowledge and discovery, and the way that people, particularly when you're very young, just seem like beautiful encyclopedias that you can open and explore, and that experience can really wallpaper over a lot of horrible things about people, particularly emotionally abusive men. But all relationships are on some level about power, and so it was important to me that we see the way that that power interchange is catnip for the character, and I think for any honest person, that's what keeps you interested in a relationship and in a story.
Mm. Talk a little bit about, because relationships figure prominently in all of your books, right? There we have this mother-daughter dynamics, we have romantic relationships. Talk a little bit about how these relationships for women in general and for your characters help shape this idea or notion of what they want. And then talk about pushing those boundaries, because all of you are pushing boundaries in the work that you're presenting. And then Laura, I want you to address how you're pushing boundaries with form and structure, okay? Anyone?
Well, I'll say, you know, for me, the relationships, like one of the things that I was just on the Audrian Rich panel and was talking about how I think there's a way that second wave feminism really affected and influenced the way that I see the world, kind of like women as a team who are fighting, you know, in sort of a war against women. And, you know, for me, that's sort of I've got a heist crew that is the central crew of this series, and different women in the crew get to be the protagonist of the book who's sort of leading something about the situation with the heist and are the ones that get to have a love interest like in that particular book. But there's something about that sense of the crew. And it was interesting. It was unclear who was going to buy the first book. And, you know, it sat on a lot of different desks and it was unclear how it was going to go. And then it got bought as urban fiction. And one of the things that's really critical in urban fiction is betrayal, right? So I had this crew of women who like had each other's back. And then I had to like write somebody in to betray somebody because, you know, I don't lean towards betrayal, right? We've got plenty of enemies out there. I'm writing about that. So that was really interesting, figuring out like writing in betrayal. And then the other thing for me that has been really interesting in terms of this crew and also relationships and sexuality. So the crew, they're heterosexual romances and, you know, mostly current and former sex workers. And there are two members of the crew who are sort of current, moving towards former sex workers, who are girlfriends. And their romance isn't particularly written into the set of stories. We encounter them as a really solid couple. And for me, they're sort of the... they're the example of love. You know, they are they're grounding the sense of love and trust for the whole series, you know, and there's a way that they're able, because of the gender divide, they're able to do sex work and engage with men for money, but they're really, really clear about where their loyalty lies. So that's been really important. They're also trans characters, and there's something about this community of sex work where a lot of, you know, where just certain pretenses are removed and folks are really having each other's back for survival. So I think that's one of the key things for me is that these women are having these relationships in an environment where there's just incredible danger, you know, where legally they're operating in a gray area, and so there's danger from the state, from the police, and just... yeah, that sense of loyalty and relationship is super strong. And the men, you know, they're romances, so the men have to kind of keep coming around and they've got to figure it out by the end. But like in early drafts, people were like, you can't have a romance where the guy kind of shows up every 100 pages. Like you have to keep building the tension. I was like, oh yeah, well, she was busy. But, you know, that in spite of the fact that I'm writing these romances, like the ongoing energy is between this crew of women who are, you know, pretty much committed their lives to each other and to their community.
But then we're talking about also how you're pushing boundaries around just the approach to these novels, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, for me, one of the things that's been great about landing in urban fiction is that, and a lot of authors of color will say, you know, when they get published as literary fiction, they're like, oh my God, it's so great, except, you know, this publisher doesn't know how to get these books into my community, mm-hmm. right? And so with my books, they go first to my community, and then they have these sort of urban fiction covers, some are, you know, a little pulpy looking, and so then it's sort of my social justice audience that's like, Aya de Leon, you wrote that, you know? And so, yeah, and so that's been really intentional, that, you know, people talk about sort of guilty pleasure books, right? Genre fiction is often, these are guilty pleasure books, but I want people to be able to have a sexy beach read that's also about wealth redistribution and women's healthcare. Like, there's no reason that you can't read, like in the Hurricane book, it's about colonization and climate change, and it's also sexy, you know, and fun. And I think in these days where politically we're so beleaguered, right, it's important to be able to have heavy politics that arrive in some kind of entertaining way, as well as the other many wonderful things that we want to read. But that's definitely been sort of something I've been playing with.
Okay. And then Laura, because I was very, very intrigued by the way in which you're playing with form on the page. Talk a little bit about that and how that... How does that speak to us having a better understanding of who these women are, mm-hmm. and then also how it impacts the engagement, the reader's engagement with the text?
Yeah. Well, in Oneiron, there are many different genres inside the novel because I, for example, use, there is one poem, not written by me because I'm not a poet, but I ask my poet friend to write it. And then there is a theatrical text, with the dialogue. Then there is a fairy tale and a few lectures, and the one main character, I could say, Shlomi Chikina, who is the only celebrity in the book because she's an artist. She's a performance artist, a little bit like Marina Abramović. I have thought her when I wrote her character. Her story is told in the context of a fairy tale interview. So it's not like just I want to play with genres, it's more like I want to really understand these characters and listen to their temperament and their personality and put it in that form. For example, that Rosa Immaculada, who is displayed by theatrical play, is because she's so dramatical person. I thought that she couldn't be told otherwise. It's the only way to tell her story. But I really hope that you don't find it too kind of complicated if you read my book. I feel that it could be easily read mm-hmm. as well, although there are a lot of stuff and lectures inside and information put inside the book. Mm-hmm. What was your second question, or was there?
That you've actually answered.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's really about the form and how do readers engage and how did you tell, like, for each voice the form that you use and how that gives us insight into those characters. So you totally answered it. And then if Tamsin and Lisa could also address how you're pushing boundaries with this idea of, you know, one, these two young women, they strike out on their own, right? They leave home for a summer and we get travel, we get journey. Talk a little bit about how you're pushing boundaries with ideas or concepts of how we should be in the world.
I mean, I was really taken with what you were saying, Aya, because one thing that was really important to me in publishing my book was that it not have like a woman's face on the cover, which is interesting because the paperback actually now does have like a figurative image on it, but I like it. I like it. It's okay. But you know, I'm not even sure that chiclet, so to speak, exists in the way that it did like 10 to 15 right. years ago. There was a real high watermark of engagement rings and martini glasses and, yeah. you know, like ladies with one heel. Yeah, always the shoes. And the reason I didn't want that was because, I mean, it's not because I think those books are bad, because I think what has happened to many books is that they've been painted with a brush of inconsequentiality.
That's right.
And that's just an attempt to sell, because selling books is so hard. And I have a lot of respect for any technique to sell books. However, if you come to my book looking for an intellectual 50 Shades of Grey, which is how some early marketing copy unfortunately described it, you will come right a pissed off Goodreads review, because there is a lot of poison inside this sexy Madeleine. You know, it's a book that celebrates sexual connection, but it's also a book about, like I said, like systemic racism and oppression of Muslim immigrant communities in Northern Europe. And so I actually am really delighted to hear that your experience with the category of urban fiction, it makes sense from what I know of it, would be much more capacious in terms of its embrace of the diversity of content. I find that people like the idea of a story that is challenging, but then when faced with challenge, not unlike the idea of like a sassy lady, but then when faced with a challenging woman, there tends to be a little bit of a, you know, fear of emasculation freak out. And, you know, that's also like why it's good to be alive, because you get to have different experiences, and some of those really challenge what you expect. I read because I want to experience different states of being. And it is my hope that my book can offer a different experience. I mean, that's a really simplistic but really true thing to say. And I think what unites all writers is that we find writing to be a useful and somewhat inevitable tool for processing our unique experience of the world. And so certainly if I felt there was a different art I could use to express it, I would love to use it. But what I've got is words. And I love the honor of being able to be inside readers' minds in that way.
Tamsin?
Oh, gosh. I so many things that were just said I'm thinking about responding to. So there was a battle about the cover of my book, which I loathe. I loathe the cover of my book. I did not want to see anybody's face, and you know, they sent this to me, and I was like, who is this white girl? Why is she underwater? What the hell is happening? You know, and she's in a short red dress underwater. I mean, everything about it. I responded so poorly that the next person who saw me thought someone had died. I mean, I was like, I was beside myself. I was enraged. But I've moved past that. And going back to the question, because it was said to me many times, right? We're trying to sell a book, right? So if I don't know from selling books of this kind, so I just had to back off and say, fine, if that cover sells this book, then I'll step back from my kind of outrage about it. But it was because it felt like all the things that the book is not, right? And so this book is about queerness at a particular point in time and in a particular community, in a theater community, the ways it was visible, the ways it was invisible, the ways it was possible, and about being seen. I mean, I said earlier that the narrator, that Nina's wrong-headed in the sense that she thinks she's telling one kind of love story that's about Sarah, but in fact she's really telling a love story ultimately that's about friendship. And the book for me was a gift for two women who've had my back, you know, at different points in time. And that was how I thought about it, and that's the love story that it becomes ultimately. So I thought that journey, and there is a lot of betrayal in here, and it is a political moment, but it's not, the politics is something that she is part of but can't see,
right? Which has to do with age, but also the circumstance that she's in. And that that was important to me.
Okay. So, and the politics that come up, right? And I feel like all of you kind of weave these critical moments of history into the book, into your work. Talk a little bit about what that looks like and how do you pick the moments in time that you wanted to zoom in on? Tamsin, there's a one moment where I think it's the space shuttle explodes in like 87, 86, or
yeah.
Something like that. There's that one moment. How do you come to figure out which moments to zoom in on and how are they relevant to the characters and the story that you're telling?
Well, that's like a demonstration of how self-absorbed she is, because she's thinking about that moment as equivalent to the experience that she's having emotionally, right? So that's what takes her back to that, which is a reflection on her and the way that she's experiencing the betrayal that she's going through. But she's seeing it as the same kind of exposure as the children. Oh my God, I'm blanking on her name. Of the first woman in with the teacher.
Kristen
Thank
McAuliffe.
You.
Oh.
God, right. Kristen McAuliffe, who went into space, and that the camera looked at the focus went to the faces of her children in that moment, and it was an early moment of that. And we watched this in school, and so it was this kind of particularly exposed and horrifying thing. Now we're all used to that. We watch that every day. We watch that, you know, many thousands of times a day. But I hadn't seen it before, and it was devastating. And she's experiencing it as comparable to the devastation mm-hmm. and the way that she feels exposed in the wake of the end of this relationship,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes those things fold in like that,
okay,
as reflections on the character.
Anyone else? Because Lisa, you very much have your political.
Yeah.
The politics is very much centered in your novel. Talk a little bit about that.
Originally, my book was actually set a little earlier in the wake of the so-called Muhammad Drawings Crisis in 2005, which was, if you don't remember, a great moment of, in my view, idiotic Danish insensitivity, where a Danish newspaper thought it would be a great idea to commission 13 cartoonists to draw images of the Prophet Muhammad, which, if you know anything about the practice of the faith of Islam, is like heresy and extremely offensive. And as I learned more about Danish culture, I was, you know, this to me just came like emblematic of like the sort of like ding-dongness of a lot of this xenophobia, because, and I don't mean to soften it or say that it's not sinister, but just that sort of like insistence that like you can play by your own set of rules with someone else's like sacred and holy objects and ideas. And I ended up making it a little later for like, I'm bad at math, and like we needed the ages of the characters to work out. So actually the Muhammad Drawings Crisis is, I don't believe, directly referenced in the book anymore. But what happened, I started this book in 2010, and in the time between then and now, the crisis of refugees and displaced people in Europe became a much, much bigger part of everyone's understanding of migration and also of sort of various political crises in different Northern European countries. I was very interested to learn about the history of Denmark as a state that, like Sweden and Norway, has been open to refugees and asylees, but unlike Sweden and Norway, where many of the people who were relocated there were quickly assimilated and given homes and jobs and the right to work, the Danes held the refugees from the Balkan War in camps for 5 years. And the children were mainstreamed in school, but the adults were not allowed to work. And this had an enormously destructive impact on the mental health of these people, many of whom were being housed right next door to people who had been hostile to them in Bosnia. I mean, they had Serbs and Bosnians living in the same communities. Again, I would say out of a kind of like doltish Danish idea that that's how you neutralize conflict. So you have a generation of sort of lost people, some of whom were repatriated, many of whom went on what's called early retirement, which is basically, you know, they live on a form of disability. And in that spectrum, there's also like a preference for the Bosnian Muslims because they look European, and they're less culturally different. So learning that whole taxonomy of hatred was really startling to me, and felt like it was part of the quest for self-discovery of this young person, because she understands tolerance and prejudice and bigotry in one American kind of naive context, and then when faced with a total reconfiguration of those problems, has to figure out how to navigate them. So it is also just a story about meeting different people and being challenged in your views and trying to square different narratives. Thank you for asking about that. I feel like I'm always talking about like period sex, which I love talking about, but there's comparatively less. I mean, I guess, okay, so very quickly what I would say is that's the other political thing about the book. I wanted to create a feminine scatology. I wanted to create an honest book about a woman's body and her relationship to it that was neither embarrassed or afraid. And I love writing about menstrual blood. And so like, you can buy one right here today.
Yes, all of these books will be on sale after the event, and our authors will be signing. So don't forget to buy a book before you leave here today. Talk a little bit about titles, because titles fascinate me. And Laura in particular, I really, really need to know how you came up with this title.
Yeah, actually, I started already writing this book, and I knew the setup is in afterlife, and it is the white empty space, and so on, many women there. And then just suddenly this name, Oneiron, fell in my mind, just out of nowhere. I don't know how it happened, but I immediately knew that this will be the title of my novel. And of course, it's not finished word, as I said, and I had to discuss with my publisher and editor that do they feel okay with this name. Of course, they were a little bit surprised, but then they get used to it. And of course, I went to Google, does it mean anything? And it comes actually from Greek, and it means sleep, which is one euphemism for being dead. And I feel that this is a huge gift to me. I'm not religious. I'm not a mythological person. I don't have that kind of spiritual contact to other places. But still, something happened during the creative process. And I'm very happy about that.
That's interesting that there was that connection between what you thought and what the actual meaning and what you were writing. That's amazing. Anyone else want to tackle that?
Yeah, so, you know, as you all can see, like everything about my experience with writing this series is very tied into genre fiction and how it landed in the industry. So the original title of the first book was The Manhattan Escort and Larceny Service, right? And urban fiction was like, no. That is way too woo-woo for us. So, you know, I was like, okay, because part of what I have... You know, part of what the character is doing in that first book is stealing things, but she's also kind of running an escort service and she's running a clinic. So then, you know, I was like, how about downtown madam, uptown thief? And they were like, we'll take half of that, right? So the first book is Uptown Thief. And, you know, at first I was like, but what about, you know, my agent was like, it's fine. And then, you know, the other thing that happens in genre fiction is like I've been contracted to write a book a year. So like basically with the title, it's like, how about this? Okay, you know, and then you keep it moving, right? So the second book, and the character for the second book is sort of the right-hand woman of the first book, and even some of the stuff about her, she was a secondary protagonist, some of that I cut out of the first book to put in the second book. And that's a story about a black woman who's coming out of the hood, goes to college, has to do sex work to get herself through college, and then has a master's in public health and is going to be taking over the clinic that, you know, they rescue in that first book. And so, you know, what came to me was the boss. You know, it's really about what happens for poor and working class people of color who then have this experience of upward mobility and are thrust into leadership and kind of aren't ready, you know, the boss. And then the third book, the title came to me from God knows where, and it's one of those books that there are actually like 200 romances with the same title, but it's The Accidental Mistress, because it's a case of mistaken identity where this, you know, immigrant woman who's sort of on the verge of realizing the American dream is mistaken for being the mistress of the like crooked strip club guy who's like stolen the pensions of the unionized strippers and skipped town, right? So You know, I liked the idea of the accidental mistress. And then finally, the fourth book in the series, the Hurricane book, is Side Chick Nation. And the metaphor is about Puerto Rico's status as a colony being ultimately a side chick or mistress status.
Ooh.
And that the United States relates to Puerto Rico in the ways that powerful men relate to their mistresses. They're extractive, and there's this sort of pretense like, I'll take care of you, baby. But what we saw with the hurricane is that the relationship is actually exclusively extractive, and the care was only a sham. And so we have a young woman who actually came out of the first book in the series. She's sort of like the tragic, you know, pimped teen who gets rescued in the first book. So in the fourth book, she sort of goes to Puerto Rico as a sugar baby, and she thinks she's found the hookup, you know, to have this sort of endless party of these wealthy guys paying for her life to happen. And so she's this sort of side chick hustle, and it's a metaphor for the relationship of Puerto Rico to the United States. And the, you know, for me, the really amazing get for this book was I went to a conference on Puerto Rico where the mayor of San Juan, Carmen Yulín Cruz, was there. And at one point, and I went with a friend of mine, Vilma Ortiz from KPFA, and she was recording it. And the mayor actually said that. She's like, you know, it's like if you have a boyfriend who's married. And I was like, oh my God, oh my God, she's actually saying it. So that's the epigraph for the book. But, you know, that, so that title just came to me, and I felt like this is, you know, because people talk about such and such nation as like sort of a legion, but it, like, literally Puerto Rico as a nation has this enforced mistress status that we can't legally are bound into and cannot escape from under the current political configuration.
That's a packs a punch in terms of a title. Talk about Open Me.
Open Me was, for its entire history, called Jutland Gothic, which was a title I liked very much. Jutland is the region of northern Denmark where the book is set. And then in the last month of the grueling editing process, my editor called me and said, no one will make you change the title of your book. And I was, even though I'd changed so much at that point, I was honestly very surprised. So my partner helped me, and we generated a list of over 100 different names for the book. And Open Me was the clear winner, although I'm proud to say that the runner-up did not win, which was Light, Lavender, and Strange, which I actually still kind of like. But the book is Open Me to me now. I think it's funny. I mean, it reminds me of Steal This Book by Abby Hoffman, which I loved to read when I was a little girl. It's a book called Open Me, right? But it's, you know, it's accurate for sort of the quest that the narrator is on. I did really think about the book as a gothic, and so it is kind of still that in my head. My joke about it used to be that it was a psychological thriller about a sexless relationship. Because what brought me into writing the book in the first place was I had never found a novel about a woman who is in a relationship where she desires her partner and he refuses her. And I needed to write the book that I needed. And so many other things came into the book, but that was really its grounding place. So I think there's an element of both command and sort of prayer in the title that I like very much that connects to that elemental theme.
Mm-hmm. Tamsin?
Sure. I also went through many titles. So many titles. This is one that we started with, Jonas Swans, and it's because it speaks to a particular line from As You Like It, and it's also a moment in the book when Rosalind's been cast out of the Duke's court, and Celia stands up and says, you know, and basically says, if she goes, I'm going with her to her father. And so it's a moment of pledging loyalty, of allegiance. And I liked that. And it's also in the book a moment when the relationship becomes public, although it's on a stage. So it's a moment between Nina and Sarah, and but actually everybody can finally see something, although it's happening in the context of a performance that many people haven't seen.
And if there's anything she wants, to take us all the way back to that, it is to be seen, right? To be seen. And that's a moment when she's seen by Sarah, but also their relationship is seen by everybody else. And so that seemed like a... That's why we came back to it in the end.
And so you said, you've mentioned this a couple times, like this desire to be seen. And I feel like one of the things that we as women want is to be seen, right? And we live these lives of visible invisibility. And many of your characters live these lives of visible invisibility. Talk a little bit about that and how that comes through in the characters that you portray here and the stories that you're telling.
I mean, to touch back on this theme of, you know, the desired body that's in denial, I took a lot of comfort during experiences like that in my own life from the mountain of literature written about men's frustrated desire. And I think, like anyone who is not the normative figure, which I guess is like a 40-year-old able-bodied white man, you get really used to putting yourself in that subject position. You're like, oh, this is a man, but it's actually me. I can be him. But then what we know about the marketing of books is that men don't develop that flexibility and that capacity. And so after a while, the sort of the comfort that I was getting from reading, like, you know, not to shoot a fish in a barrel, but like Goodbye Columbus or something, right? Like, was just like, where it's like a Greek tragedy about a girl refusing to use a diaphragm for a teenage boy's pleasure. I started to get really sad and angry. And so I think that there's something meaningful and important about the pain of being, you know, involuntarily celibate, which is why it's really sad that that term has been co-opted by a violent misogynist movement, because there's a conversation we don't have about what it means to be denied intimate contact. And that doesn't mean that people are entitled to it, but it does mean that it's a significant spiritual wound that develops. And so that, to me, was the visibility that this protagonist was seeking, not to be seen as beautiful or hot or desirable, but to be seen as worthy of intimate touch. And yeah, that's what she's after.
Well, I think one of the things about writing Heist with these women is just, you know, Heist for men, you know, there's this long tradition of men, you know, we're going to steal this. Yeah, okay, the team, okay, and it's like slick and they're figuring it out. But for women, you know, that visibility and that hyper-visibility as well as invisibility in terms of women's roles is always really important, right? Mm-hmm. So part of the heist is always there's someone who's got to seduce and get close to somebody to get inside information so that they can pull it off, right? And so that's a really important piece. And it's, I mean, one of the things that's been interesting about writing about a sex work community is that my characters in this particular series are more sort of mainstream looking than what I usually write about, because, you know, they are all sort of in sex work, and this could be a huge tangent, but, you know, there are many ways that people who are more commercially attractive make more money and are more successful. So that's been one thing that's sort of a given for a lot of these characters. And in my other books, I write about folks who come from more of a range of appearance. But that's part of it, that visibility and that attraction. And also in writing Heist, it's like you're looking over here at this person who's dressed like this or behaving in this provocative way so that you're not looking over there at these people who are robbing you. You know, so it's very much about, I think both sex work and heist are about women saying, gee, in patriarchy, this is a really crappy setup where we're valued for this. But given that that's the setup, we're going to figure out how do we work with this.
Laura, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, maybe. There is different... women are different from different ages in my Oneiron. And even it's a female community now, because they are only people around and with each other. One figure who has died for cancer, throat cancer, and who is described more or less not very good-looking person, she feels kind of envy towards a young woman, Ulrike and Maimuna. Maimuna, actually, from Senegal, she wants to moved to Europe to be a model. She's very beautiful. And this Vlippis, very hard to pronounce her name, she's from Holland, she thinks that, for example, Maimuna and Ulrike get more space there to speak out because they are young and beautiful. So even death hasn't made them equal. But in the end, I think that these problems can be solved in the book because they really understand that they have to get through this limbo state, which they are in, to find a kind of final peace. And they have to help each other to find it. It's a kind of travel story through the landscape of death. And they have to kind of collaborate.
So audience members, you have any thoughts that you'd like to share? Questions for our panelists? I was going to try and integrate you into the conversation, but I was so engaged with our panelists. I would really like to know what kind of questions you have around the idea of what women want and what these women are writing about.
Hello. I was sort of curious just with the heist books. There's two movies that recently had sort of the same theme. I was wondering if you're like, hey, you took my ideas, or if that sort of more visibility in movies helped or hurt you, or I don't know, your feelings just on the commonality.
Sure. So Bitch Magazine asked me to review Ocean's 8, and I did. And it was a star-studded cast. I think the thing that I was most frustrated by, I think it's online if people want to read the review, Bitch Media, they didn't give the women their own space, and it was too referential to the boys, but they didn't let her fully boss up, and I was mad. As well as just, you know, I'm a Robin Hood heist writer. Like, I don't write stories about women who are like, let's enrich ourselves with illegal means. You know, it's like, what is this money for? So there is that. But I'm excited anytime Hollywood, which is like so much more conservative and slow moving, particularly in film, is able to move in the direction of having women in the center. I think overall, if women are in the center and actually doing something, it's moving in the right direction. And then the other thing was my Twitter really blew up when Hustlers was announced because people were like, isn't that your series? Did you write this? Did you write the screenplay? I did not. And it's based on a true story, right? So a true story, I believe, from the 80s. I think I'm a sort of rising tide, lifting all boats type. So I'm excited, you know, that the stories of women, particularly women of color, fighting and heisting and stealing stuff and getting away with it, is moving forward. I think prior to this, it's, why can't I remember the name now of the like 90s heist film with the four black women, Queen Latifah.
Set It Off.
Set it off.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, for any spoiler alert, like, you know, they don't really get away with it. And so that for me is super important and really connects to the theme here. What do women want? We want to win, you know? So I like these stories of women who fight and win. And so ultimately I think, you know, anytime Hollywood can even imagine these ideas, I think it's good.
What did you think of Widows?
Oh, I just saw Widows on the plane.
Me too. Like 2 days ago.
I know, totally, like last week. What did I think of Widows? I mean, I thought the plot was really interesting. I won't spoil that one because it's more out there right now. It's like if you hadn't seen Set It Off by now, sorry. You had 20, 30 years. Widows was a super mix for me. I like gangs of girls who are nicer to each other. I think that was a thing that was missing for me, that there wasn't that sort of camaraderie. It was more of like a solitary woman who like figures out how to have these transactional interactions with these other women. But that said, like anytime I can look at Viola Davis for any period of time, it's just a good time in my life. Like she's so beautiful and so, for so many reasons, just not anyone that was ever in the center of any kind of film or television in my early life. And she's so powerful and lovely. So that part was good, and there were parts of the plot that I liked, but, you know, at the end, like, meh.
Any other questions from our audience? We have time for maybe two more. Yes.
Thank you. I'm from work in the film industry, and I'm just wondering in terms of, you know, you've talked about writing to genre and dealing with the marketing, and I'm wondering how you're negotiating having to compromise what you originally want to do with what really are patriarchal enforcements on your art and what you want to put out there, because it's really powerful in film. And any thoughts and tricks and things that you're planning or doing? Love to hear them.
Well, I guess I can say, like, for me, that was part of the intention. Like, I was going to start with a group of women who had already kind of made certain agreements that are the co-opting types of agreements, right? You know, like, I remember when Sarah Paretsky's work got made into film and how she was so incredibly heartbroken and disappointed, right? So I was like, how can I write something that even Hollywood couldn't co-opt? Because they're already naked. They're already, you know, like, everything was already happening. It's already filled with action. There's already a romance. So I decided to co-opt those tropes myself so that I could create something that could be commercial, but I had made those decisions internally. And, you know, I have a film and TV agent, and at some point it might get picked up, particularly in this era where content is explosive in film and TV in ways it hasn't been. But that was my strategy, was to sort of pre-co-opt it and then see where it went.
I would just add to that, I'm in the very early stages of working on a pilot and also like a story that might be optioned. And it's really interesting, as someone with very little dramatic writing training, how much more plot-driven, and in my experience, that does mean like kind of patriarchy-driven, a lot of like film and TV writing is. And I think it's like what I've like the very little bit that I've learned so far is just that you try to find like a trend that feels sexy and try to like turn it against its masters. Like I'm writing a show about a woman who joins a coven fighting toxic masculinity in the form of an anti-vaxxer cult. And so, like, you know, it's like you try to Trojan horse in.
That's right.
The feminism.
Yes.
I got a question right over here.
It's really a lot of food for thought. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I want to ask you what probably, in terms of a relationship where between two women, where one is more masculine and one is more feminine, how that is different in terms of versus a male-female relationship, where in some ways the woman who's more feminine gets a certain privilege from the culture, and yet she may feel like she will give up a certain power. There's more. It's a different dance. Because it's just within and without is what I'm saying. So anyone want to respond to the power? You talked about the power dynamic and how that's different within a lesbian relationship or bisexual, whatever, versus a heterosexual relationship in terms of the balance of power.
Anyone want to tackle that?
I mean, the thing that I would say is, first of all, that's April Sinclair, who's a fabulous author in her own right.
Yes.
You know, for me, like I said, the lesbian relationship in my series is the moral compass of love, you know, and the love between these two women. One is bisexual and more femme. The other one is a little more butch, but because they're sex workers, she's always sort of having to be in a certain kind of femme drag, and one is a woman of color and one is white. So I think, you know, if we look at it intersectionally, it's hard to just pull out, you know, with the relationships that I'm writing about, it's hard to pull out just masculine and feminine because there's so many things going on. Another character is bi and, you know, has relationships with both men and women. And, you know, but she's also this kind of incredibly beautiful, charismatic stripper, but she's also really dark-skinned, and so she's dealing with colorism both in her personal life but also within the sex industries. Like, there's horrible colorism within the sex industries. So I think, yeah, that, you know, in working with sex workers, there's, you know, hyper-femininity is generally valued commercially more, but then there are lots of different moving pieces to that, and also whiteness and lightness and proximity to whiteness is generally valued more. But again, you know, there are twists and turns depending on the communities that you're working in. But I think that's one of the reasons that I want to write about a spectrum of relationships, because, you know, there's no way that you can really get any kind of full picture around sexuality if you're, you know, only writing heterosexually. And so that was super, super important to me. And, you know, obviously different books have different scopes. Not everyone's trying to take that on, but I was really trying to take on something really broad with sex. And I wanted to have lots of different kinds of sex. Paid for sex, romantic sex, compulsive sex, queer sex, straight sex. Like, I'm, you know, I got a lot going on in there.
Yes, she does. So we're at time, folks. I want to thank all of our panelists for their, one, for their work, and two, for joining us this afternoon. I want to make sure that we do get a shout out to our sponsors for this event, and they are the Philly, F-I-L-I, the Finnish Literature Exchange, the Barbro Osher Pro Susia Foundation, and support from Women Lit members. Please remember to go outside and right to the left of the doors are book sales, and to the right of the doors will be book signing. So please make sure to grab a copy of these wonderful books. Thanks so much again.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.